The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're broadcasting live from our studios in New York City and streaming live over the Internet. You can watch the program by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or GaryKnoll.com. My guest in about a half hour from now will be Rodney Smith. He is a teacher and author of the very important work on Lessons from the Dying and Stepping Out of Self-Deception. I'm going to ask Rodney about the many ways we deceive ourselves, the ways to cut through self-deception. In other words, to live a more authentic life. I think you'll find the discussion interesting because he comes from a Buddhist background. All that we can know about the healing process that's in the scientific literature, we explore that each and every day here. And what's important for new listeners, and we have lots of new listeners, I want to thank you for coming on board, considering we have no foundation, we have no media campaign, no advertising, no publications or publicity at all, and still, you should see the numbers. They are mind-numbing. Coming on board. Why? Because they're receiving insights from perspectives that most of the other media simply do not cover. They have their own agenda, and all you have to do each day is watch what programs on the major media and cable and even internet, what topics they cover, how do they cover them, what's their agenda, and then listen in how we cover things, and then make your own choice. We believe in empowering people. By the end of this hour, I can promise you, no matter what your background, you will have new and important information to help heal the body, mind, and spirit. Let's begin. There has been no reason for controversy surrounding vitamin C for a simple reason. 28,000 plus studies in the scientific literature attest to what vitamin C is about and what it does. Let's just add one more to that. From the journal, peer review journal, Cancer Research, done at Otago University. Here's what it says. Researchers at the university have come up with another good reason to eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. They can help fight cancer. The researchers published in the International Journal Cancer Research shows vitamin C can help prevent cancer and curb the growth of cancer cells. Lead researcher Professor Margaret Weiser said the research was the first real evidence of a connection between vitamin C and tumor growth, which has been debated for years. People with cancer use more vitamin C than usual, so their levels tend to be lower. She said the study showed eating vitamin C-rich fruits and vegetables, such as kiwi, red peppers, oranges, could prevent the formation of tumors and increase patients' responsiveness to therapy. Okay, she is really wrong on one point. There have been multiple studies on vitamin C and its role with cancer, including some that go far beyond just eating your fruits and vegetables, because there's only so many fruits and vegetables a person can eat. And also, let's say you're diabetic. Well, you're not going to be wanting to get your vitamin C from fruits if at the same time that could exacerbate your blood sugar levels and your insulin levels. So that would be counterintuitive. But taking vitamin C orally in buffered form, in the most easily absorbable form, that's reasonable. But intravenous for serious conditions, especially cancer, is most practical. And there's good evidence on that. If you were to interview in depth all the physicians in the United States who've used intravenous vitamin C over the last 20 years, they would be in the thousands. Their patient records then would be in the millions. And yet no one has done that, nor has anyone actually taken the time to study this. I think it's a very worthwhile study. I would hope that we might find someone in this audience who has the background and the patience to do this. For example, first get a list of all holistic physicians. That we have. Then contact each one and say that you're doing a survey. Their names need not be used if they're afraid of making it well known that they use intravenous vitamin C because of some of orthodox medicine's capacities for attacking them. But just how many patients have you treated? What are the conditions? What dose range do you use? What is the protocol? 3 days a week, once a week, 5 days a week? And how do you graduate your patient up and then back? What length of time is the study? And then what are the outcomes? Then you take that and you pull all that data together. Now, when you have thousands of physicians giving you input on millions of patient visits, then that qualifies as a very good insight article. It's not a clinical study, but rather it's a clinician's observation review, and that has merit. So this is a good study, but it's a simple one, and this has been done a lot. I'm just surprised that this Professor Margaret Weisers wasn't aware of all the other work on vitamin C and tumor growth. Next up, research, brand new research. Again, this is from Genome Research, the peer-reviewed journal, shows that vitamin D is linked to hundreds of genes. And what does that mean in lay language? What that means is this, that the results of a genome-wide mapping of the vitamin D receptor, which was found to exist on 2,776 binding sites, and the researchers responsible for the finding also demonstrated that vitamin D, your sunshine vitamin, and your colubrol vitamin, directly affects the activity of 229 genes, including the gene associated with multiple sclerosis, and PTPN2, which is associated with Crohn's disease and type 1 diabetes. And vitamin D affects the genes via the vitamin D receptor, a protein that binds particular genome locations to influence gene expression. Now, in lay language, this was done, by the way, at the Wellcome Trust Center on Human Genomes at Oxford University. What does this mean? It means that when you have the right amount of vitamin D on a daily basis, either with sunshine or without, that you're going to have a positive expression of those 229 genes, therefore helping protect you against Crohn's disease, type 1 diabetes, and multiple sclerosis, or helping prevent the deterioration if you should have those conditions. So it's all good when it comes to vitamin D. Now, a lot of you, I happen to know for a fact, are using your green leafy vegetables. Now, ideally, you buy locally grown, organic produce in season. That's the best. But the reality is most people are not able to get a wide variety of locally grown organic food 12 months a year. In the summertime, it's easy. And in the late spring, it's easy. But then the further in the year you get, it's less likely because a lot of places just not are going to grow it locally. And then you have to be concerned about getting it organic and certified organic. And then how long has it traveled? Because fresh produce, especially leafy vegetables, lose a lot of their antioxidant quality when they've been boxed and shipped and exposed to various temperatures, whether on airplanes or trucks or trains. And then how long do they stay in a store? What is the temperature? Generally, people don't take any of that consideration. You're going to buy a head of lettuce. You don't know when it was picked, where it was picked, what conditions it's under. All that is important, but impractical. It's one of those things that we should know, but the reality is we're not going to. But we know we have to have our veggies. That we definitely have to have. And the more vegetables we have, especially the cruciferous vegetables, and the more variety, the healthier we are. That's just simple. According to the British Medical Journal in the new issue, they took a look at what is called a meta-analysis. That means meta-multiple studies. And they showed that increased intake of leafy green vegetables could lower the risk of developing diabetes. Now, this was done through the University of Leicester in England. And fruits and vegetables supply the antioxidants and phytochemicals that combat free radicals, which are associated with the early phases of development of several chronic diseases. So quite simply, the higher the intake in the fruits and vegetables, the less free radicals, and hence the reduction of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and cancers. It's just that simple. And so here they took a look at a lot of studies involving over 223,000 people ages 30 to 74, and follow-ups of those studies were from 5 years to 23 years. So you're looking at really good data. And what they found was that for every increase of 1.1 servings of green vegetables per day, it was associated with a 14% reduction in developing type 2 diabetes. Quote, this is from the study, and this is why I like to read the studies myself. Results from our meta-analysis support recommendations to promote the consumption of green leafy vegetables in the diet for reducing the risk of type 2 diabetes. The results support the growing body of evidence that lifestyle modification is an important factor in the prevention of type 2 diabetes. The potential for tailored advice on increasing intake of green leafy vegetables to reduce type 2 diabetes should be investigated further, unquote. That's from the British Medical Journal. I saw this in no newspaper. I heard it on no broadcast. Maybe it was someplace. But I thought this was really important because it looked at all these studies. Now, for you, if you can't get it all fresh, local, with a great deal of variety in my garden, which I hope to see sometime in the next 6 weeks, because I love going out and planting, at any given time year-round, I have about 80 to 100 different type of vegetables growing. And I have filmed all this. I just haven't had time to put it up online to show you how you can have fresh, locally grown organic produce 12 months a year. Even if you live in the worst environments in the wintertime, I can still show you, not on a commercial level, I can show you for your own family use how to grow. If you had 8 foot of snow out, I'll show you how to grow parsley without it being affected. And if it were scorching hot, 110 degrees, I'll show you how to grow it and protect it. Indeed, even though I was not at my ranch for most of the last 3 months because of my traveling and lecturing and research, there were still crops growing. And I had a local person come in and tend to them and take pictures and show me what was growing. And even when it hit 100 degrees, 102 degrees, and the ambient temperature, the ground temperature was much higher, everything was just growing like crazy. So that's good. Now, the second best thing, but for some people absolutely crucial, is compounding powders, meaning You take all the good veggies we should have, like broccoli and kale and Brussels sprouts, and you get them and you take the powder. Now, that actually gives you more. It gives you a heck of a lot more. In fact, almost 21 to 1, because you can only eat so much raw, because the raw is made up principally of lignocellulose, which is good for your intestines, but your body doesn't absorb it. Then water, and then the actual chlorophyll or healing phytonutrients are trapped inside that. And when you juice it, it's released. When you blend it, some's released. It's always best to take the juice because the blend, you're getting an awful lot of the fiber, sometimes too much fiber. But for people who've had a normal American diet, they haven't had enough fiber. They're constipated. They generally have some form of gastrointestinal problems, generally parasites. If you eat in restaurants a lot, there's a high probability that you have some form of parasite. People don't realize how easy it is to get parasites. Do you ever think of it this way? I never use utensils when I go into a restaurant. I always either take mine or I take a permanent pair of chopsticks. Now, that you can take home, wash, and reuse. The less chopsticks you use, the less trees have to be destroyed. But let's say someone comes over and you get a napkin, you get a fork and spoon and knife. They were handling that. Were their hands sanitary? No. Did you ever watch people actually sanitize a table in a restaurant? The only way you can sanitize a table in a restaurant is put down paper or cloth, meaning you, in your better restaurants, they do that. They take off the cloth and they put down a new tablecloth, or they put down a paper tablecloth. But most have wood, and with wood they just come up with a dirty rag and they wipe down your table. Well, what if someone had hepatitis and sneezed on the table? What if someone had adenovirus, and they sneezed on the table? Now it's on the table. And they wipe it, now it's on the rag, and they wipe every other table in there, now it's on every table. And let's say they're handling the silverware, it's on the silverware. And did they sterilize the glass you're drinking from? Depends. At what temperature? A lot don't. In which case, then, let's say someone had herpes, and you've never exposed yourself to herpes. Drinking from a glass in a restaurant where the glass is not sterile, you could pick up herpes. That's how easy it is. So we have to understand sanitation and hygiene are crucial, but also getting your vegetables in concentrated amounts is crucial too. So if you're an average American and you get on a raw food diet, that raw food diet is going to help you, give you lots of fiber that cleans your gut, chlorophyll that cleans your blood and organs, phytochemicals that detoxifies and helps rebuild the DNA. And that's why people who shift from a meat-based diet feel so much better for the first 4 or 5 weeks. But if you have too much fiber, then you don't have enough time for food to be assimilated as it goes through the intestine. And hence the irony of it is, if your intestine is going too fast, you can end up with some nutrient deficiencies. So when you have a combination of good food, ideally locally grown, and then have yourself a couple scoops of your compounding powder, then you're not only getting what your body needs, you're actually giving your body more than what the person would ever normally get, and that's where you start seeing your actual rejuvenative cell repair, DNA repair, detoxification effects. And the more you do it, the better you feel, the greater the results. And then one day, 5 years from now, you look in the mirror and you don't look the same age as everyone else. Your age, you look much younger. Your skin's healthier. You're less body fat indexed. Your eyes are clearer. Your breath is sweeter. Your body odor is less. New study just shows that meat eaters have more foul body sweat odors. That's the latest. And one last thing, the Mediterranean diet is protective against ultraviolet light-induced skin damage. Now, you might say all the people living in the Western Mediterranean, there's the Eastern Mediterranean, I'll deal with that next week. I want to show about the difference between the other side of Italy and then the Mediterranean. Because the Mediterranean, when you talk about the Mediterranean diet, you're talking about an awful lot of countries, because it also includes north area of Africa and some of the Sinai Peninsula. You have to look at all the other countries, and I'll go through all the countries. I'll start with the countries that are inland, like Russia, and then the new federated countries that were part of the Federation that are now independent. I'll go through all of those in great detail, and their diets, and their lifestyles, and their longevity, and things we can learn from them. You know, then you go further out into the Balkans, and further out into the various shorelines, and you'd be amazed at how healthy some of the people are in the Eastern Mediterranean, the old Soviet bloc countries, especially those people that lived at the ocean and had farming in their family for hundreds of years, much healthier. Now, that doesn't mean everything in their lifestyle was healthy. There's a lot of smoking, but they're living longer lives. But always a curious point on the Western Mediterranean, Spain, France, Italy, there are other countries, but let's use those for a moment. You don't see high levels of skin cancer. And especially in women, it's not easy to tell their age. Generally, the first thing I can look at and tell a woman's age or a man's age is their neck. How much folding skin, how much turkey skin, and what is the composition of that skin? That's almost always a dead giveaway. Then the back of the hands. You look at a woman from Greece in Italy, you can't tell easily how old they are. And yet they're out in the sun a lot. Here's just one of the reasons. Quote, this is from Nutrition Reviews. And this was done by Dr. Shapira from Tel Aviv University School of Health Professions. It says, the diet consisting of foods consumed in the sunny areas surrounding the Mediterranean Sea may help protect the residents of those countries in developing melanoma, skin cancer, and if it protects them from melanoma, it means it protects them from other damage to their skin. Hence, their skin will stay younger, longer, less damaged, longer. They won't have that California leathery, cracked skin, really looks bad, you know, from those people that were sunbathing early and now they're in their 30s and 40s and whoa, it's bad. I've seen so many Italian and Greek citizens that are in their 60s had the skin of a 30-year-old. Now this study shows one of the reasons. It's the antioxidants that, quote, protect against ultraviolet light-induced skin damage. Well, hello, that means if you live in Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, all exposed in Southern California, all exposed to heavy sunlight, the more antioxidants in your diet, the more protected you are from skin damage. It's just that simple. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, people from all over the world tuning in, and we try to address issues that are universal. So it wouldn't matter where you lived in the world. I just had some emails this morning from people from Iceland. We will address issues that are common to everyone. So that's everything I just mentioned thus far affects everyone. Joining me in studio is executive producer of our Natural Living programs on the Progressive Radio Network and all of our sister stations, Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. It's great to it's been a while since I've been in this room.
Yeah.
So, Gary, you know, over the past year and a half and all, you've been gathering together information. We bring on all these guests and different economists from different walks of life, different countries that have been looking at the financial meltdown, and pulling some of their best ideas in addition to your own thoughts and insights into trying to create a stimulus, economic stimulus plan, as a means of educating our listeners and to leverage with other legislators. Politicians eventually. So I'd like to have you speak, address some of these issues. I think one of the main ones we like to, is now that in the recent news we have learned that Treasury and Tim Geithner and all has in so many words has come out stating that, you know, the Home Modification Act is pretty much a ploy just to advance the banks, and yet foreclosures are continuing. We are facing more and more homelessness, and there's more and more people going into poverty.
What I always like to do is I first like to look at the larger picture and then piece by piece construct the picture as each one is a puzzle. And if we understand the various pieces, then we're not running around with one piece like the Democrats and Republicans are doing now, neither of which is the whole truth, though there may be some aspects in it. For example, the conservatives say slash spending, mainly social spending, entitlement spending, privatize Social Security, cut back Medicare, cut back Medicaid. The Democrats say, no, you know, let's expand spending, let's do another stimulus, and let's pump more money into the marketplace so that people can be hired to do work. They both have half-truths, but neither has a stimulus plan that will actually function. In the next 3 weeks, Richard and I will publish a major article, as we have in the past, on what we consider a truly progressive stimulus package based upon what will actually work. But first we have to understand what we're dealing with. And if we fail to understand the larger body politic, then no matter what we're suggesting, it'll only be considered some utopian pipe dream. First, why is it that we simply can't hire people to do meaningful work that does not in any way consume the rest of our budgetary or discretionary spending? It's all about power. We don't have an economy in the United States. We have multiple economies. And each economy is controlled by a certain faction of people. And let's start at the highest point. Who actually controls almost all the major elements in the United States as far as policymaking? These would be the policymaking elite. Now, the policymaking elite are probably in the neighborhood of about 3,000 to 5,000 individuals. These are people that you rarely hear about. You may have heard their names, like Rockefeller. David Rockefeller is one, for example. And in his mind, I'm sure, having founded the Council on Foreign Relations and many other organizations and foundations, he believes in his mind that based upon his background and his family's experience and the success they had, that he is doing the right thing for everyone. I won't question his motives. I won't question his morals. I will question the concept of Keynesian logic, trickle-down theory. Give money to the most powerful organizations. Give it to the largest multinational corporations. Bring it under the umbrella of globalization. And with that, you will have prosperity. It's never worked. It is an illusion. It's a myth. Now, these individuals don't have to work. We're talking about people who are between $500 million to billions of dollars. They're just billionaires alone. They're over 1,300. But if you include the others who are very powerful and very wealthy, who are ruling elite, they're in the ruling class. Now, also in the elite class, but not policymakers and not ruling class, you have in the neighborhood of about somewhere around another 2,000 to 3,000 individuals. These are people that don't seek to change policy. They simply engage and indulge. These are the people with the mega yachts, the mega planes, the mega mansions. And, you know, they will go off Saint-Tropez in a 300-foot yacht with a whole retinue. And you see these people, for example, in Russia, the Russian oligarchs. Oligarchs are not the brightest people in the world intellectually. I've spoken with them. All right? You would think they're smart. Frequently, they're just gangsters who knew the right connections and used their power and influence. Frequently not even dynamic energies, but rather adaptive, aggressive life energies. But now their emphasis is upon, how can I make myself feel better? Let me buy the Nets team, right? And as long as they have the money to spend, the media goes towards what they're buying, what they built. But you won't see these people sitting down and telling you how to make a better world. They don't know how. They're not highly literate. They generally haven't gone to the better schools. But they are extremely aggressive, and their whole lifestyle and their retinues are all based upon show the world how the elite live. Ironically, the power elite, the ruling class, which are equally rich or in the same class, these people tend to live more conservative lifestyles, more often than not. They choose not to be in the public eye, and they choose to be taken seriously. They're workaholics. Now, those are the people, the policy-making ruling elite, those are at the top of the food chain. Under them are the rather irrelevant, super-rich elite, but not ruling and not policy-making. So they're not the same. then you have a big divide, and then you have the most lethal, the most cavalier, and the most dangerous people in the United States. The Washington policy elite. Now, there's two groups within Washington. There's the Washington policy class. One group's elite, and these are generally people from Ivy Leagues who have been a part of foundations, Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission. If they're in the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and the Council on Foreign Relations, they've been groomed. These are not people who are just working themselves up. These are people that are, because of their ideology and because of their views, are being given access to the, for example, the table, the business roundtable. And that business roundtable says, you will get ahead of the line. You'll see them then frequently popping up on television as experts and talking heads. Now, these people in Washington are the very wealthy ones. Like Nancy Pelosi is worth about $90 million. Now, she is in the political elite, in the political class. But just like the policy elite in the ruling class, you have those that have the power and are listened to and have whole operations and foundations and charities and media that they control and own, like Rupert Murdoch would be in the ruling elite. But he's also in the policy elite. Trust me, Rupert Murdoch does everything he can to control policy through the editorializing on his stations and in his newspapers. Ironically, Obama's not in the ruling elite yet because he's not rich. He hasn't compromised enough for his handlers. You know, that's what confuses people. George Bush is not in the ruling elite, and he never will be. But his father is, because his father associated himself with the Carlyle Group, and almost all the buddies in that group are very rich and powerful. And so therefore the father, who is charismatic, becomes a part of the political elite, but his son is simply in the and the ruling within the political elite, and his son is simply, you know, in the political class. But you have a lot of people like Barney Frank. It's worth maybe $980,000, not a million yet, and he is in the political class, but he's not in the ruling political class. But look at all the compromises he's made in the last year alone. Mm-hmm. Terrible compromises. That gives him access to a different level when he gets out. When these people get out of office, where do they go to work? Back into business as a school teacher, a social worker, a pharmacist, a physician? No. They go to the council and say, we want this, and the council says, okay, you gave hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars in contracts, and deregulated these industries, so pick your job in pharmaceuticals, in banking, in military, in energy, it's yours. Suddenly they're a $5 million, you know, Tom DeLay annual consultant. So you have two classes in Washington. You have the political class that become elites and the political class that does not. Then you have Washington. You have Wall Street. Wall Street, you have about over 1.5 million people in the financial service industries. I'm not talking about low-rung bottom feeders. I'm talking about the powerful groups. Within that power group, there's about 1,000 who are elite. So within the Wall Street economic class, you have about 1,000 elite. These are people who are policymakers. What they say goes. And then all the others trying to be like them, but never will. But they'll make $1 million, $2 million, $5 million. They'll buy a house in the Hamptons. And because there'll never be someone that actually is invited to give their opinion, all right, you're ahead of this foundation, and you're going to create a policy in education for South Africa, or for whatever. They'll never have that day. So how do they sublimate their frustration and anxiety? I'll show you. I'll build a mansion on Long Island. I'll pay astronomical amounts for a penthouse. So they rent the private jets. Their life is ostentatious. Everything is a gamble. So in Wall Street, you have two classes also. So you see, you got two classes in each of these divisions. Then you get to the people that really control America, the Business Roundtable. They're the most powerful group on Earth, more powerful than any other group of people alive. Now, we've always had elites, and we've always had powerful groups, but we've never had this many divisions in them. Today, we have about 8 million millionaires. These are wannabes. Most of these are private entrepreneurs who made their money either investing or in trust babies, and now they're going to spend it. But they're not that bright. They're more interested in joining local causes and getting their name in the social columns for, you know, what charity they gave money to, or what celebrity they had a picture taken with. So forget them as far as policy anything. They don't exist on a policy map. They're not a threat to anyone. They're just overly indulged, selfish, greedy-based people who are so insecure they don't even have children. Their children are raised by nannies, private schools, they're all on Ritalin, they're all addicted to something, and they're going to go out there and they're the next group of really spoiled, petulant, selfish brats. They created Generation Sub-Zero. Then you have the professional class. Now, the professional class is about somewhere in the neighborhood of about 6 to 8 million professional class. Lawyers, engineers, doctors. These people have come down a big notch, most of them. And now they've had to radically change. But interestingly enough, they're opinion leaders, not policymakers. So they impact a lot of people in the decisions they make. And then you have your upper middle class. That's about 40 million Americans. They generally don't do anything about policy, but they live comfortably and conservatively. And then you have your working middle class. That's about 120 million people. And these are people that work but are struggling. And their investment was in their home or their condo. And now that's underwater. And finally, then you get to the new middle class, which is the new poor middle class. They're working, but at two jobs. They're making less money, and they've got bills they can't pay, and they're losing their homes, and they're struggling, and they're borrowing, and there are a lot of them, about 60 million. Let me give you some figures. If you took the most conservative number, $22,000 a year for a family of four, which is just incredible, then you're dealing with, and this 2008 figures, you're dealing with 40 million people. And of those, we have an astronomical number that are children. For example, 13% of all U.S. Citizens are now considered in poverty, or at the poverty level. And in children, that's 10.6% of all Caucasians. That's 19% of all African Americans. That's 19% of all children in the United States live in poverty. 19%. All right? And that's like one out of five children in the United States lives in poverty. In fact, 2,600 children will be born every day into poverty in the United States. One out of 50 children in the United States are in dire poverty. 34% of all African-American children live in the poverty belt. 30% of all Hispanics live in the poverty belt. And then that deals with 24.7% of all blacks, 23% of all Hispanics, and 8.6% of whites. Now, these are just numbers until you realize that's we're having 40 million permanently poor people in America. They're virtually invisible. And from that permanently poor come your homeless, now over 7 million. It was just 5 million 2 years ago. So I just wanted to lay this out because when we talk about helping stimulate the economy, what economy are you talking about? If we're talking about making something happen, how can we make something happen when we're not looking at the individuals in the communities in which they live and who is capable of participating? Now I'll go quickly to the stimulus. Here's how we can save everybody, make the quality of life good for everyone, reverse our country and go into a surplus with zero debt, zero. This stimulus actually reduces all debt and still have universal health care, which I support and always have. Do not touch Social Security. It's the individuals, not the governments, to use. But make stricter standards on Medicare and on Medicaid because of massive fraud. First and foremost, to help the largest number of people immediately, I project that we could put 30 million people, or virtually 90% of all unemployed or underemployed Americans, back to work. Give zero interest loans for 3 years to 5 million American business people either new business people at the local level, but under the following criteria: the jobs must stay local. For each $1 million you give a person interest-free for 3 years and then only 2%, because you're giving them the same deal you're giving the banks, except that at the end of 3 years, the banks still are at 0%. So you're charging them 2%, which is a 200% return on the investment, which means that the taxpayer is getting their money back. But also, for every $1 million that a person gets in a loan, they have to hire two employees at $30 an hour. Okay, that's a living wage. Now, let's just say that the average person takes $3 million loan. You've just put 30 million Americans to work in every city, town, and municipality in the United States. Now, you do the following. You also de-ghettoize America, which also reduces crime and dependence on drugs, which I believe should be legalized, which would stop a lot of this nonsense. But how do you do that? You set up in every community a charity that caps money that can be paid, so only a small administrator. Administrators are only paid what the average person is paid. All right, so nobody exploits it. And then that money comes from corporate America, giving a two to one write-off. For every dollar you give this charity, you get a $2 write-off. That does not exist now in the United States. Corporations would love that. So now what happens is this, because then that money doesn't have to go to an offshore corporation and be hidden from taxation. Now what you do is you use that money to rehabilitate with the cooperation of the city and the state, abandoned buildings and decrepit buildings. You rehabilitate those and you build housing, quality housing, not junk housing, but the kind of quality housing that Habitat for Humanity, that I think does great work. They're heroes, in my opinion. And you don't sell the space, so you don't have gentrification or displacement. Instead, you rent it at 15% of a person's annual income. So therefore, even the poorest of the poor American will have a place to stay, but those who have a decent income but not don't have excess will still have money, and therefore be able to contribute that money within the local economy. You build, you rehabilitate existing schools, but you change the entire educational system back to a different way. The way we have it now, No Child Left Behind and all these other schools, are an abomination. And you stop the nonsense that goes on with the negotiations of the way teachers. You basically, the teachers should not be given tenure after 3 years, because we're giving a lot of bad teachers tenure, therefore protecting them. Instead, teachers' pays should be based upon the quality of the student's education. We just have too many teachers who are training students to pass exams so the school district looks better, but not preparing this child for what they need to know in life. We should have thousands upon thousands of tutorial programs in inner cities to help students and families that are having problem children, having a problem learning, so that the whole system doesn't have to be floated. Because a floating educational system means you take your the least intelligent student and the most intelligent, you float a standard of education. You overstimulate one and you understimulate the other. It doesn't work. Then you build all arts and cultural centers. Bring the artists back into this inner city with beautiful workshops and galleries that are supported and controlled by the community, not private gallery owners. So now we have a renaissance in arts, because now artists can show their work for free in galleries and share the profits 50-50 to the gallery, which then goes back to the charity, so that the next child that has an interest in art will not be deprived of being able to master it and develop skills because you're supporting it. So we bring that back. You develop community gardens, holistic assisted living centers, drug intervention centers, senior citizen aid centers, and theater. The things that a society needs in order to flourish. So we de-ghettoize America. It costs the American public nothing, and we get rid of the ghettos, crime, delinquency, and we put about 5 million Americans back to work. Now, last two things. We then give 100 acres, the old 40 acres in the mule, we give 100 acres free to a family or an individual that's willing to live on the land for at least 10 years, And 25% of all the crops they grow go to local food banks. The rest they get to keep. But they must use non-genetically engineered, meaning they must use organic heirloom seeds, use biodiverse crops, and then give that land that we're now using in biofuels for corn and soy, give it those millions of acres. We could put 2 million American families on farms, which would give them a quality of life, save the soil. And then finally, we put together our own form of a CCC program, Civil Conservation Corps program. We plant 15 million trees in every state in America, all 50 states. That reduces carbon emission. It creates carbon sinks. It creates water tables and watersheds. It stops wind erosion and stops erosion. And we hire local and young people for that. That puts 3 million kids to work. Now, then where do you get the money for some of these? You reduce the military-industrial budget by what it does not need in order to make America safe. Currently, on and offline, it's $1.1 trillion. $250 billion was spent last year on supporting 865 military bases in 40 countries. We need none of that. That's $250 billion right there wasted. $250 billion would virtually improve and repair every single infrastructure, bridges, dikes, dams, levees, tunnels, gas, water mains, reservoirs. We could then put emergency centers to help people when there is a crisis in every single community in America. So the next Katrina, the next flood, the next hurricane, you will have a place where people can go and have food and lodging and medical care and some even as places for the kids that would be virtually disaster proof. And that's no more Katrinas. That's no more oil spill disaster for the people. And where do we get that money? From cutting the military industrial budget by $800 billion, getting rid of all subsidized subsidies to the energy cartels, the farm cartels, the health insurance and pharmaceutical cartels, and the bank subsidies. If any bank cannot survive, take it through structural bankruptcy and get rid of it and have it reorganized. And then the same thing with any other corporation. So no longer does this happen. And then cut the size of government, the federal, state, and local level, to the necessary level with community oversight and input, so that a governmental agency actually exists to serve the needs of the community with community input and oversight. Let's bring democracy and citizen participation into government. Well, now it's completely excluded. Let's deconstruct the spy state that we have become. We have 16 secret agencies. Get rid of all of them. We only need one agency. Get rid of and then go through and have a group of constitutional scholars, progressive constitutional scholars, get rid of about 90% of all the laws that we have. Bring back onto our books those regulations necessary to protect us, whether it's the Glass-Steagall Act, and then ban trading in commodities essential life. You can no longer trade in currencies, water, oil, gas, and food. And then you take a look at what we have, and you have gotten rid of poverty, you have rehabilitated inner cities, you have made government accountable, you have given us more health, and if a person signs up for Medicare, by law, they must take classes and review material on preventative lifestyle to prevent the diseases. We would save $3 trillion a year under the stimulus I just mentioned. Is it doable? Yes. If you look at the numbers, we will expand this in depth. Hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Gary. We will have more time to speak on it.
All right. I'm Gary Knoll. My guest, we're going to start today, but we will continue with my guest tomorrow. I'm sorry that we ran over there. We didn't intend to, but that happens. I didn't want to cut that short. So let's go immediately over and say hello to Rodney Smith. I introduced Rodney and the topic earlier in the day, and I gave you his background and the topic of the many ways we deceive ourselves and the ways to get through self-deception. Thank you for being with us today, Rodney.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rodney, I realize it's going to be just an opening interview today. We'll have about 13 minutes, but we will continue this if you have time tomorrow.
Okay.
And I will give you all the time that you need tomorrow, an hour if need be. I'm going to give you one introductory sentence, and then I'd like for you to take it and so we can see how we can run with it from there.
Okay.
Before we explore some of the peculiarities of America's seeming addiction to gratifying ourselves solely, hence giving rise to a duality between us versus them, I would first like you to juxtapose the Western notion of a permanent self or ego with the fundamentalist Buddhist principle of anatta, or the independent self in the absence of a separate ego, and then briefly summarize the idea of anatta in the context of the Buddhist view of emptiness in general.
Well, that's a tall order in 13 minutes, but let me address it this way. Millions of years ago, there was a paradigm shift that we chose, and that was that as our species evolved and as we descended from the trees onto the plains of Africa, we weren't very quick to escape the wrath of animals in their attack, nor were we very ferocious in being able to fight off those attacks once they occurred. So what we had to develop was something else, and that was our cunning. And one of the ways that we did that was we started to think abstractly. We started to see things differently than the way reality presented them. In other words, we didn't see a stick as a stick. We saw it as a potential spear or a weapon or even an axle later on in our development. And what that abstract world did was allow us to survive as a species, which was enormously important, of course, but what was the downside of thinking abstractly was that it began to confuse us as to what was reality and what was an abstract or conceptual idea about reality. Now, many millennia later, we are in that fix of not really knowing the difference between reality as it actually occurs and what we're thinking about reality in terms of our own internal response to it. This creates an enormous schism between what the world is actually holding and how we interplay and affect the world from our ideas about it. Now, if we bring ourselves up to current time, I think we could all see that our species is under enormous duress and perhaps in crisis from a number of different sources. One, there is some 7 billion of us on the planet. Also, we have diminishing resources that has been occurring ever since we started using them. And perhaps more dramatically now is the climate crisis that's in front of our eyes. And we don't have any clear resolution or determination towards that resolution. All of these crises are a result of that original perceptual distortion that occurred some however many million years ago in our species. And that distortion at its heart was very simple. When we create an abstract idea about something, we also have a story and a memory of how we have used that abstraction in the past so that we can use it and actually benefit ourselves in the present or future as we need to.
Well, we're just saying, by the way, that music is our theme. For saying goodbye to WMYE, and people can continue listening by going to GaryNull.com. Rodney Smith, my guest. Please continue, Rodney. What you're saying is very much in alignment with what so many people have said, that we're a collection of memories,
yes.
Some major, some minor, some good, some bad,
yes.
And instead of dealing with the real world and its real issues in real time,
right.
And being mindful of the moment we're in so we can make unfettered choices,
right.
We then react, and our reactions are almost always then without our control.
That's right. That's exactly right. In fact, I was listening to an NPR radio lab the other day, and the title of it was Who Am I? And the neuroscientists said that you can't really pinpoint a place in the brain where you're located. All you can do is show the neurological responses of some billion neurons that carry a bit of information about us. So you might say we're a billion people, not just one person. And that organization tendency by the mind to organize all those millions and millions of bits of information then allows us to see the world in a very distorted way. And that distortion in its fundamental essence is the sense of separation that we see the world from, that the world outside of us and the world inside, the one that we claim ourselves to be. but it doesn't have any basis in science. It just has a basis in the brain's organization of the data as it's coming in. And so what we begin to perceive is that we live in a very self-centered world that has no scientific fact. And if you look at it, we're always the center of our universe. Have we ever had an experience in which we have not been the center? And that sense of I is the default position for our assumption of how our perceptions are organized. And so what my book tries to do is to take that as the heart of the problem and not to try to find a solution within the same paradigm that created the problem to begin with, but rather to look at this whole thing as a paradigm shift to a different kind of world in which unity or oneness is the basis for its truth. And that is really what all spiritual traditions, including Christianity, has at its heart. In fact, I just saw this quote from Jesus in the Gospel of St. Thomas. He says, when you make the two one, and when you make the inside like the outside, and the outside like the inside, and the above like the below, and when you make the male and the female one and the same, that all shall be resolved. And so I want to emphasize that it's not just Buddhism that has this distortion of perception at the heart of what it's trying to fix. It's really many of the major religions. But we have made it into a religious issue rather than a species issue, a survival issue. And I think now is the time to look at this as a survival of our species issue.
I appreciate that insight. We're going to wrap up our program now. This is just a brief little coming attraction for tomorrow, and I'm going to set plenty of time aside, probably as much as a whole hour, because I want to go into exploring the concept of emptiness.
Sure.
If you're versed in physics, you understand emptiness. Mm-hmm. However, for most Westerners, there's a very strange, almost irrational concept, especially for people raised in monotheistic cultures. Why is the idea of emptiness so easily misunderstood? And in Western terms, how do you explain the proper way we should understand the ideas of emptiness without being nihilistic? So let's tomorrow begin our discussion. Now that you've given us a little preamble to your thoughts, on dealing with the individual, dealing with emptiness, dealing with the ego, dealing with the illusion, what I like to call the illusions of our stories, the myths of our stories.
Yes, good.
If we can get out of the myth of our story, then we see the reality of our story, and sometimes that is enhancing our sense of self, and sometimes it devastates us, especially for those who believe they are something they're not, based on what they've created. And how often do we create artifacts to the myth of the undeveloped self? Rodney Smith, thank you very much for giving us just an oh-so-brief introduction. I look forward to sharing this whole discussion with you tomorrow, unabridged, unedited, and with plenty of time. All right?
Great. Thank you.
Rodney Smith lives in Seattle, Washington. He'll be back tomorrow for all the time necessary. We just didn't have time today to get into it, but at least I gave you a chance to hear who he is, so you can tune in tomorrow. And we're going to deal with a lot more. I'm continuing tomorrow with a much more in-depth on a whole lot of other areas, my ideas on taxation and other ways we can help society. Rodney's book, by the way, is Stepping Out of Self-Deception. Earlier we had a leading psychiatrist on our program, holistic psychiatrist, earlier in the week, and he is traveling, did not want his phone number given out, but after the 26th of September, he will be back, Dr. Peter Bregan, and when Peter Bregan comes back, he will be on the air, and therefore he'll have a chance to talk with people. He didn't want people being frustrated trying to reach him and not be able to communicate with him. So please be patient. That's the only reason I didn't give out his phone number or contact information. He has not to. Coming up right now on the Progressive Radio Network, one of the most progressive minds you're ever going to see out there, Mike Fader and The Turning Point. Nice to have you with us today, Mike.
Thank you, Gary. Nice to be here.
We look forward to listening to you in just 60 seconds.
Thank you.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.